Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to this very special podcast dedicated to The World's End, the third and final part of Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg's Three Flavors Cornetto trilogy. Later on, we'll be talking to Messrs. Pegg, Wright, and Nick Frost as they spill on the secrets of the film. But first, we're going to natter on about it ourselves. But be warned, as you might expect from a spoiler podcast, we're going to be talking spoilers. Lots of spoilers. And we've held off on releasing this until after it's out in the States, so British listeners have had 5 weeks and therefore no excuse. Then highly to your local multiplex immediately and then come back. But if you have, then let's begin. I'm joined today by Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
Ali Plum.
Hiya.
And Nick Desemlian.
Hello.
How are we all?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent.
I've had 12 pints, so I'm actually under the table, but I've got the mic.
Four Empire journalists. So far I'm seeing one water in a cup, one tea.
Mint.
I've got a bubble, which is a water filter thing filled with water. And Nick, you actually don't have anything.
I've just had 12 pints.
Okay.
You just said that, didn't you?
Literally had 12 pints. Yeah. Okay, fair enough. So let's have a quick chat about The World's End. First and foremost, a fitting conclusion to the Three Flavors Cornetto trilogy, or the Blood and Ice Cream trilogy, if you prefer that title. Mm. I don't prefer that. I prefer Three Flavors Cornetto.
That's because you're more art house, I think. I really enjoyed it. I think it's a very, very, very well-constructed story, very well told. They really took some risks with this one. You know, they've got a sort of a leading man, a protagonist, who is not immediately sympathetic. He's not as sympathetic as Sean was, or even Nick Angel. And I think that's a really good decision in the end, because it forces you to kind of work at it a little bit and also makes it a more interesting film than I think it otherwise would be. So I really enjoyed it.
There's so much more depth to this kind of comedy, to their kind of comedy, than the usual cookie cutter stuff we get. No offence in particular to The Heat, but that's what's currently in my head. Where you go, well, how long did this take to think up? But you watch The World's End, and whether you like it or love it, I'm giving you two options. you know there's lots to it. You know when you watch it again, they'll be, oh, they did that, that's genius. And then the third time, and the fourth time, and the fifth time. And that depth, that this is treasure trove feeling is what's exciting about it.
Yeah, this is a multiple viewing movie, definitely.
Definitely.
I've seen it at the time of recording. I've seen it 2.5 times because I saw the first 46 minutes whenever I was writing the feature for Empire. And Edgar Wright showed the 46 minutes to me, and I enjoyed it. Then he cut off at the exact point in the cross hands after they encounter and fight the blanks for the first time
in the bathroom,
and then it just cut to black in the bathroom, and then it just cut to black, and I was like, no. So it took me a while to see the rest, the other 62 minutes, and I've seen that twice. And the second time around, you see so much, and there's a little reference, for example, the first time when Martin Freeman's character Ollie is on the phone to his sister Sam for the first time when they're in the old familiar, and he goes, oh yeah, oh, did he get lost in the ring road again? And it's just a little throwaway line. You just think it's a little, but then it happens to her later on at the end of the film. She only comes back because she got lost in the ring road again. That these guys, their scripts are just
very tight.
Precision form, just beautiful.
There's an insane level of foreshadowing in this. Definitely when I saw it the second time, almost every line, and even that prologue right at the beginning when you see their younger selves. Everything links back to something that happens later in the film.
We had to bench him, and then, of course, they do have to inadvertently.
Yeah, them getting para in the cricket pavilion or whatever it is.
That's the
paranoia.
I mean, everything down to the posters for the school disco that they go to, the posters have figures with glowing eyes on them. And that's actually a fairly common kind of nightclubby looking poster, but obviously in this case, not, you know, there's again a clear link to the aliens and so on. I just love all that. I love all that detail that every time you go back and watch it, you're seeing more stuff that you didn't even realise. And it's the same with Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz. I mean, this is not a new thing for them. It's absolutely,
no, absolutely
been there since the beginning.
Famously in Shaun, the speech where Ed and Shaun are in the pub, and Ed basically lays out the entire film, but in the form of, we'll go to, you know, have a load of drinks. And the opening of this film, The World's End, as Nick said, does effectively the same thing. But there are so many little references when they get off the train station. It's like, we're following Gary King into oblivion, or we're going to get annihilated, and obviously it's more obvious, but
yeah. Did any of you guys catch the numbers?
Which numbers?
There are numbers corresponding to each of the 12 pubs in the scene in the pub, which I didn't get at all. I didn't even get number 12, which is the most obvious. Which the pint at The World's End is on table number 12.
It's on 12,
yeah. Ah.
I didn't get any of that.
Oh.
So where could we find some of the other numbers? Don't tell us all of them, but where are the other numbers?
Oh, I don't know. I spoke to Edgar about the soundtrack last week, and he gleefully described some of the stuff we might not caught, and I frankly barely caught any of it. So this goes to show. And I've seen it 2.5 times as well. But I think the nerdiest one is that the brewery, the made-up brewery in the film, is called Windshire, which is the name of the fictional county in John Wyndham's The Midwich Cuckoos.
Oh, very good.
You almost got that. I'm sure I almost got that. Yes, I didn't get it.
Funny, John Wyndham's having a bit of a moment by proxy at the moment because, you know, there's a little bit, there's definitely Wyndham-esque stuff in here. And Pacific Rim also has a bit of a Wyndham quality. If you've seen that, there's it links to a book of his called The Kraken Wakes. So go read some more John Wyndham, everybody. He's good.
Mm-hmm. Or indeed, just read some John Wyndham because I've never read John Wyndham.
You've probably come across it, The Midwich Cuckoos, Day of the Triffids.
Yeah, I've never read it. No,
he's great.
I've read John Christopher, but I've never read John Wyndham.
He's part of the sci-fi canon.
Quickly, to the Kindle store!
On this mythology thing, I like these films unabashedly. And this mythology thing that kind of floats my boat is because when you're watching something like Man of Steel or other super hero movies or things with their own individual back catalogue like Star Trek, they're playing with previous incarnations of what they're doing, sure. Right? Previous takes on their thing. This is them who are so confident, so strong, they're making their own mythology for each film. Aside from the Cornetto rapper at the end, which was a touch of genius, there isn't that much that directly connects it to the other films. It is its own movie, and it's strong enough in itself to have its own structure that you go, oh, that's clever, but not because it's hat-tipping a alien that didn't turn up in the previous
movie. Yeah, because I think whenever we first heard pubs, we first heard there's a larger threat, we thought this could be a Shaun of the Dead retread, and absolutely isn't that.
No.
And a large part lets down to the choices they made with the characters as well. Other things, other links to the other two films, by the way, The Fruit Machine in the King's Head. Mm-hmm. It's the same noise.
Which is called Ooh Ah Dracula.
Ooh Ah Dracula, there we go. It's the same Fruit Machine in
Shaun. And of course, The Fence Clasp. Jump.
And of course, The Fence Jump.
I mean, they are there, but they're kind of grace notes rather than,
yeah,
look what we're doing. And I'm looking at Star Trek Into Darkness here, another peg joint. But yeah, where you go, not lifted wholesale, but lifted to a lesser or greater extent. Yeah. This is kind of a lot more subtle and knowing.
Yeah. It's interesting, for example, that they did The Fence Jump, but they didn't do What's a Problem? Yeah, What's the Matter? Never Taken a Shortcut Before? Or they didn't do Want Anything from the Shop, for example. It would have been a bit tricky to crowbar that into a 12 pub crawl, but it's good they didn't go down that road.
Wasn't that a last minute addition, The Fence Jump? They decided to do that,
The Fence Jump was a reshoot, yes.
Yeah.
And the Fruit Machine thing, apparently Edgar said he did it 2 weeks before the film got released.
Really?
He'd forgotten to put it in.
Amazing.
Wow. But it is impressive. I mean, despite those little last minute tweaks, I mean, this still feels like a much better thought out film than virtually anything else this summer. I mean, so many films this summer have felt very much like they were assembled by committee. And in some cases, we know they literally were. But, you know, they've felt like, okay, yes, we're doing that, but we've got to do this for the fans. We've got to do that for the mainstream. We've got to, you know, have this thing happen here, and this one, it just feels very much like they've got a vision, they're staying true to that, and that's what they did on screen.
In my mind, comparing it to the first two of this trilogy, it's, I agree with you, when I first saw it, I went, this is going to be a repeat of Shaun of the Dead, maybe. I think it's a cross of the two. Now, you have the zombie-like characters which you are fighting in a kind of automaton, unstoppable force way, and then you've got the...
But very stoppable.
But very stoppable, and yet they come back to life instantly. But we also have the, for the greater good, beigeification of the world, where we just want things to be nice, but we're willing to do bad things because we want the world to be a nicer place, and that's Hot Fuzz's thing. So I feel this movie is a... tonally and thematically is those two movies together, which is part of the reason why I got such a satisfaction by the way it ended, is it went, okay, we've taken those two things and this is the conclusion of this trilogy and we're following through with it.
Yeah.
We are getting the apocalypse and a semi-happy ending.
Yeah, it's a ballsy ending because usually, you know, it's, you know, we talked about this with, as you'll hear in a minute, with Nick and Simon and Edgar, but usually our heroes are fighting to stop the apocalypse. And as it turns out in this film, our heroes have fought to bring about the apocalypse, which is a pretty out there kind of thing to do. And, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Did it on the hoof as well, because he, without realizing quite what he's doing, goes, you're all a bunch of pricks, I'm paraphrasing, we don't want any of your weather spoonification and
starbucking,
that's it, goodbye, end of the world. There's no, like, should we think about this?
Well, of course Gary doesn't know that's going to happen.
Yeah,
but I do think it's a it does continue the line of that character who blunders into every situation, but also by the end of the movie, I mean, Gary, I know some people already have seen the film and they have a problem with Gary.
Yeah.
And I think if he were played by anyone other than Simon Pegg, the movie would be completely stone cold dead. Because but Pegg has such an innate-like ability that he gets you past your initial problems with Gary, who's a very, very selfish character, who is an alcoholic, who has lots of problems. But by the end, you are rooting for him in his final diatribe against the network. You are rooting for him. There is a moment where it just clicks for him. And he's behind the bar and he goes, okay, then, you know, and you actually see almost the sea change within him. And I think by that point, you're rooting for him. And it does have the best line in the movie, or the line most people are quoting anyway, which is, why don't you climb on your rocket and fuck off back to Legoland, you cunt? Which is just genius.
Hmm. Did you notice who was the voice of the network?
Yes, Bill Nighy.
And I asked, this isn't in the spoiler section interview, but I asked Edgar, was that an intentional joke? The end is Nighy. And it was. So there you go.
They're operating
on at least 14 levels.
Wow. he changed his name 20 years ago just to prepare. Yeah, I also like the detail that set at the end was circular, which kind of goes back, I didn't get that until the second time, that goes right back to the group therapy bit right at the beginning.
Oh, great.
Where
Peg
is in that kind of thing. Yeah. I was like, okay, they've modelled that set after that.
I was on the set at the World's End when I visited the set. It was they were doing the hole in the wall scene. I was taken by the production designer Marcus Rowland on a tour of the World's End, and he was like, this descends. I was like, what? Yeah, there's a little button that they press and the whole thing goes down.
Wait, so they actually set that up in a...
They actually set it up, yeah.
I would love to have seen that.
I know, it was pretty amazing. It was about 30 feet high in the air. It was great.
Shit.
Yeah. I didn't have many problems with the movie. I did think that the climax was a little bit muddy for me. I'd be curious if it was for you guys as well. When they have the younger robot Gary, were they offering to transfer his consciousness into a robot body? Because I was a bit muddy on that.
To my mind, what they offer... when you see this with Martin Freeman's character, who I forget the name of, when he becomes a blank, he is still him. He's got all the memories and the life knowledge of what it is to be his character, his person, his human. But he's in this body which is essentially plastic and Lego-like. But he's drunk the Kool-Aid. He's part of the gang and he agrees with what they're saying and is kind of on board and on message. You're still you.
I think there must be various levels, because they can clearly sort of download memories to these people to a greater or a lesser extent. Because you see people who, you know, clearly have no memory of these guys, and the guys conclude that is because they are robots. Mm-hmm. If you remember at one point, it's like, oh, that's why the guy in the pub didn't remember us. It's not that it's been 20 years and he forgot. It's because he's a robot. Whereas later on, it's clear that they've been downloading the memories they want another barman to have into him.
Yeah.
And so there must be different levels. They must be able to control exactly how much of your personality they put in to the empty.
And then they've chosen leaders who obviously, in my mind, obviously, susceptible and very keen on this idea, i.e. Pierce Brosnan's teacher character. As a teacher, he wants what's best for you, all that sort of stuff. He's obviously somebody who really agrees with what they're doing. So he is chosen as the vessel that is really on board.
Because the authority figures are still in charge, like Steve Oram's cop.
But it's a bit confusing, because if he really loves what they're doing, the network, then why has he had a replaced body? Because if he does love what they're doing, then he wouldn't need a replaced body.
Maybe he doesn't genuinely love it. Maybe you're being harsh on him.
Yes, maybe the real Pierce Brosnan teacher character actually loathed this shit. Mm. But they used him because he's a figure of authority in the town as a vessel. There you go, that makes sense. I've worked out for myself.
I am now cross-eyed. I'm going to have a 13th pint.
Go for it. Speaking of things you may not necessarily notice at the first time around, the surnames of the characters in this film, we've got Gary King, Andrew Knightley, Stephen Prince, Oliver Chamberlain, and Peter Page.
Wow, his noblemen, his court around him.
Which makes sense with the ending, when you have those Gary King as the leader with his big hat and his four trusty servants.
Mm. And they also do the King Arthur story, that comedy routine. Kind of works with the King thing. Also, did you spot that Oliver's Bluetooth headset, which he's always got on, has a blue light only when he's been turned into a blank, when he returns from the bathroom? So for the rest of the film, it's on, has a blue light on.
That's a bit amazing.
That is a bit amazing.
I like that a lot.
Also, did you notice at the end he has a football for a head?
What?
Did anyone else?
No,
anyone
else
spot
that?
Which apparently was a real football that actually was put on Martin Freeman's head.
Really?
Yeah, so he was just walking around blind for a little bit. It's not a CG effect, it's an actual real football glued out of his head, which would be awesome if true. Yeah. I really like the idea as well. There was a lovely shout out to the Three Musketeers Five Musketeers thing as well. What I like about this film as well, I love the relationship between, ultimately between Gary and Andy. You know, those two guys really come into their own towards the end of the film. And Nick Frost is hilarious once he starts drinking, when he crashes through the door of the pub. I think it's either the trusty servant or the two-headed dog. I need to rewatch it 3.5 times now to see it, to get that into my head. It's just, he's just absolutely brilliant. But one of the things I really love about it as well is that I think more so than Sean and Fuzz, it's a true ensemble piece. And it's great to see. I love the fact that they give so much for Paddy Considine's Stephen to do, and he's so important to the story as well. And in fact, he's actually kind of the romantic lead of the story, which is great. But also Eddie Marsan is, I think, almost this movie's comedic secret weapon.
He's the breakout hero.
He is, and it's a bit of a shame what happens to Peter ultimately. I can see why they went with it. You know, there are numerous references to the Five Musketeers, and at the beginning, you know, Gary even says, "Oh, you can kill two off and still have three." But it was a little bit of a shame. But he's so funny, you know, just giggling along to King Gay 10 minutes after hearing it, or doing incredible burp acting. How does he deliver dialogue and burp at the same time?
Rada, darling, rada.
Money well spent, I think.
There's a great trailer for Filth where you can see Eddie Marsan rubbing his nipples on the dance floor. It is the most incredible. If you don't watch the film, that's up to you, but watch the trailer. Do yourself a favour.
This is a year of Eddie Marsan being debauched.
And then you think to Happy-Go-Lucky and you go, this is not... He is amazing.
You think of Tyrannosaur.
Shit.
Which was the last time you worked with Paddy Considine.
I've already blanked that out of my head.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's...
Deliberate blank.
So yes, I thought he was spectacular. He made me laugh. Per joke, he made me laugh the most.
Should we talk about the pub signs?
Go for it.
How many clever things are there on the pub signs?
I think the most obvious one, I'm sure the one that everybody spotted, is the fact that the King's head is in fact the Gary King's, Simon Pegg's head.
Yeah.
In a fright wig.
In a fright wig. And also the trusty servant. The trusty servant on the sign of the trusty servant resembles Michael Smiley, which is great. Also in that scene, we had Reese Shearsmith on the podcast, Nick, and I think he and Michael Smiley filmed their cameo in The Trusty Servant about a week after finishing on A Field in England. So, you know, if you hadn't already got your fill of Smiley Shearsmith action, that scene delivers.
Mm. The mermaid is the marmalade sandwich.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Blonde, redhead, blonde.
Very good.
The cross hands is the same configuration of putting a hand just above the wrist as well, which is what happens in the film.
Very good.
The thing that made me chuckle and also get a bit weirded out is that when the twins, who are obviously the two-headed dog, which at times when you say that out loud sounds quite sexist, but I don't mean it that way, when they get defeated but not quite defeated, the one of them comes back and has feet and legs on the shoulders.
Yeah,
right. So she has become a quadruped, i.e. a dog,
mm-hmm.
i.e. the two-headed dog.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of brilliant and also weird, because I don't think I'll ever see another film in my entire life where I'll see somebody beat somebody else or try to beat somebody else to death
with leg arms,
with their twin sister's leg arms. It's just bizarre.
When you put it like that, it is quite weird.
I guess that's one of the nods to John Carpenter in this movie as well that I really, really like. Something we haven't discussed with the filmmakers yet, so I may be completely off the point here, but that does feel almost thing-like to me, the idea of a two-headed dog person with leg arms, but also the numerous shots of the blanks standing in the street, immobile, watching our heroes as they go about their business. Really recalled for me, and again, this might not be the reference, but Carpenter's Prince of Darkness, where lots of homeless people do that outside in a really creepy fashion.
Oh, yeah.
That's Midwich Cuckoos for me.
Yeah. They're not very subtle, are they, the blanks? In what way?
They don't have to be.
In their surveillance, yeah.
They don't have to be, do they?
I have a slightly unanswered question. In the first fight, in the... cross hands?
Yes.
Yeah. In the bathroom, the blanks turn on the hand dryers twice to drown out the noise of the fight, but I'm assuming that everyone else in the pub is blanks at that point?
Maybe not quite.
You think there might be a few...
I think there might be a few...
humans in there mixed up with it at that point.
Do you think any humans in Newton Haven aren't aware of what's going on? Because Michael Smiley's character, Reverend Green, is kind of in cahoots with
them.
He knows what's going on. But do you think there's anyone who hasn't, A, been taken over, or B, doesn't know exactly that that's a little bit weird? You know, is there that sort of body snatchers element to it where...
Are there maybe kids or something?
There are people who are unassimilated.
Yeah.
If I do have a problem with this film, and I'll be honest, I do have a problem with this film, in so much as what I'm about to say, it's the mythology that goes around how this works as blanks. Like they seem to be replaceable, and then if you kill them, how do they die? That electricity they seem to suck from the hand dryer. How does that work?
That's not. They don't suck electricity from the hand dryer.
What do they do then? What are they doing? They just is that just
it's to make noise so that people don't hear the fight.
And when they pop the heads off, they just pop them back on. That's fine. How do you make them die and not come back? There seems to be a...
You have to smash their heads to kill them.
You smash their heads, but then you can put on someone else's head, and then that's fine.
Yeah, I liked that. But I take your point. It's a little bit confusing.
For these guys, which I've just been singing their praises in terms of them taking everything to the nth degree and really explaining things and structuring it, that the whole mythology around them as baddos is confusing for me. And maybe I'm an idiot, but it confused me at times. So there.
Well, in more exciting news, I've just downloaded the Kraken Wakes and the Midwich Cuckoos while we've been doing this very podcast. So there you go.
Fantastic. Enjoy.
Everyone's going to be happy.
It's a Kraken good read.
Hey, I'm going cuckoo for John Windham.
Chris, you were saying something interesting to me the other day. Ari Basil.
Yeah. Well, I had this little theory that there's a character called Basil played by David Bradley who shows up halfway through
and doesn't murder everyone.
Doesn't murder everyone.
Nice for a change.
Yeah, precisely. And he delivers a ton of exposition. So I was kind of wondering, was that a deliberate
Basil exposition
reference? And I've had it confirmed by Edgar Wright that it kind of was and kind of wasn't. That he was based on someone that Edgar actually knew growing up in Wells in Somerset. But I don't know why it went Somerset, but they did refer to him as Basil Exposition while writing it, but it wasn't necessarily a deliberate Austin Powers reference, which would be a little out of place, as we said, in this movie. But
I must say his crazy straw theory. Line made me laugh, I think, more than anything else.
Really? Yeah, I love the way he clears his throat before he delivers the block of exposition to Stephen. He goes, ahem! And he carries on, which I really, really liked.
It says here on the cast list, obviously we don't need to talk about it really, but we've got the likes of Alice Lowe that we spotted and all that stuff, and Rafe Spall is one of the people who gets shown around the house early
on. No Sarah Vinowich. Oh, disappointed about that.
Yeah, that is a shame.
Jessica Hines,
yeah. Mm. Simon said they didn't have a role that they thought was worthy.
She could have played the twins. Jessica.
She could have played the twins, but then that would have been more of effects. And
not just that, that would have kind of been weirding me out to see those two.
But you get that slight bit of weirding out seeing them interacting with, you know, Mark Heap and Julia Deakin.
But at least that's kind of in and out, like kind of it's done reasonably quickly, where if they actually had a massive fight scene. Did anybody spot Garth Jennings?
Yeah, he was in the trailer.
So where was he?
There's a shot of him. I can't remember the pub because I've only seen it 2.5 times. But there's a shot when people start to stare at them. There's a free shot of three guys standing at the bar, and he's on the left hand side, looking quite sinister because he's not a sinister man. Garth Jennings, he's a lovely man.
He
summed up all his menace for that shot, I think. But he is in. He does cameos in lots of things.
He's all over it.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you for answering my question.
Good. Any other cameos that we liked? I mean, the Brosnan cameo is going to be discussed in the interview portion later on. Continuing our grand edition of X Bonds, Lazybees next, presumably. So, anyone else that we missed that we liked?
No, we've mentioned Bill Nighy. Mm-hmm. And that was the main one. I mean, obviously, we've also, you know, touched on the spaced alums who show up. I thought that was all good. It didn't take you out of the film. It was just nice to see the sort of the ensemble cast kind of reunited a little bit. But no, it wasn't. I mean, this isn't a film that has sort of stunt cameos all over the place. It doesn't sort of want to fill its boots with all their celebrity friends. It just kind of goes with people who would fit in the environment, I think.
I liked how if you see the opening group therapy session, the actress who played Mary, the zombie girl in Shaun of the Dead, is sitting beside Gary.
Oh.
And the twins who were zombies in Shaun of the Dead, and they were the Michael Butchers in Hot Fuzz, show up in the very final scene as well, as the guys in the Auntie Blank's pub.
Did you spot the name of that pub?
The Rising Sun.
Yeah, I saw it's the Sunrise, but it probably also was Rising Sun now I think about it. That's actually a pub name. That could be a good pub quiz question. What is the name of the 13th pub in The World's End?
And because, as you'll hear in the interview portion, there actually was at one point a 13th pub as well.
That's a double whammy trick question.
So that would have been the 14th pub.
Yeah. Double 13. or something. I kind of felt like with that final scene that they should do some kind of comic book spin-off sequel, just chronicling the post-apocalyptic adventures of Gary and his gang of teens.
Gary and the Blanks. That's a good band name. Write that down.
It is a good band name. Fantastic. I think that I would like to see that. I would read that. I would be interested to see what happens next.
Well,
but I don't want, and I'm sure they're not planning a film sequel. I just want to see it in a comic.
They're not. I mean, that's a great thing about their movies so far, is that they've resisted the temptation to sequelize them, and I think they always will resist the temptation. And, you know, I don't know what the story is with Sean, honestly. I don't see that there's a story there to continue after that, because at some point, Ed is going to rot away to nothing. It's just going to be Sean and his skeletonized best mate just sitting there like, dead.
That's a really gloomy thought.
I know.
I do want to see a Hot Fuzz sequel, I'll say it. You know, because, come on, all the films that it's kind of inspired by have sequels. But yeah, Hot Fuzz 2, the Bad Boys 2 equivalent.
They did talk about that, didn't they? They've joked before that it would be called Pigs in the City. Nicholas Angel and Danny Butterman live on in another universe. And the same with this as well. You know, would you want to watch Gary and his blank friends running around having adventures? Or, I don't know.
Not in a film. I just think it could be a funny comic. Literally just a one-off sort of what happened next, I think would be hilarious.
Okay.
I think it would be great. You could go to the Thunderdome and hang out with Tina Turner. I'd watch that.
We don't need another hero there, okay?
Oh. That'd be amazing. Any other little Easter eggs that people may have missed?
The guys get the train from High Wycombe train station at the beginning, because that's where the movie Quatermass and the Pit is set.
Ooh.
Which is another inspiration. And also the five bars of light that is the Bill Nighy kind of character at the end. Those five bars appear lots. Apparently there's graffiti. They're on recycling bins. And it's the logo for the made-up brewery, Winshire.
Oh, so keep very an eye good. Out for that.
Winshire or Winshire? It's spelled W-I-N-S-H-E-R-E.
Well, that's like, you know, a bunch of different county names. They're there to trip up Americans who have no idea how to say Worcestershire sauce.
We're Worcestershire. Lugabaruga.
So Winshire.
Just have a pint of it and relax.
Yeah, sit back, relax.
Ooh.
I'm reassured by your brother, Philip de Semelin. Nick, that the couple of letters have been faded out on the side of the train that they come in on. So it's not Chiltern Railways, it's Chiltern Aleways.
What?
That's astonishing if that's deliberate.
I would love it if it weren't deliberate. I would love it if all of these things that we give them so much credit for, and you go, oh, that's clever, because that references that. And then Simon and Edgar are going, yes, of course. We don't just use the same ideas over and over.
I assume with those guys that it is deliberate.
Yeah,
I'm more likely to, more inclined, yeah, because there are other directors where you go, oh, did you mean to do that? And they'll go, no. But I think with these guys, they do think a lot about this stuff.
Mm. Can I double check something? They've said this is the final of the trilogy. Now, they never really designed it from the outset as a trilogy. Does this mean we're not going to get another movie with Nick and Simon in a lead role / reasonably big roles? And Edgar directing.
No, I think we will.
So we will see that, but that won't be part of this thing.
What I think we might get, ultimately, say 5-6 years down the line, because I obviously interviewed them all quite extensively for the feature we did in Empire, where Nick, you were a zombie in our World's End shoot. There you go. That's why we chose the man. And they all talked about it. You know, they're definitely going to work together again, but it just might be in a different combination. So it might be Nick directing, for example, from a script that he wrote with Edgar, maybe. Yeah, but I think, honestly, you might get either just a straight comedy that doesn't have any genre overtones, or you might get some sort of drama, or who knows. But it's also interesting to note that the way that the Simon and Nick relationship has evolved over the three films, so they might be enemies next time. They're actually facing off against each other, which would be a nice dynamic that we haven't seen. And, of course, Paul as well, as in terms of their evolution.
But don't tease me. If it was those guys head-to-head, I mean, that would be... That'd be weird.
Yeah, that'd be great.
My money's on Nick.
It'd be weird, but great. But it's weird in this film to see them fighting as well at the end, in the World's End. But it's that sort of drunken mates having a go at each other thing that, you know, I think we've probably all seen. And then immediately it's resolved with a kind of a, yeah, I love you guy. You know,
shut up.
Yeah, he's a cock, but he's my cock. You know, which I really, really liked. And in fact, I loved all the way through that the modulation of the drunkenness, which they actually hired a physical comedy expert to kind of work out with them to gauge. Okay, so maybe you're 6 pints in, so you'd be this drunk, but once you've fought 40 people, your adrenaline spike will take you down to about 3 pints. But then once that wears off, you'll actually be more drunk than you were initially. So it's great. I love the sequence when they go from the good companions all the way through the trusty servant, and they're just getting progressively more pissed. You know, they're just falling off bar stools and burping, and it's just that stuff is really, really fun. But hey, drink responsibly.
Let's talk about the music, because the music, as with a lot of Edgar Wright joints, is great. Like,
they've spent
a lot of time yet again over this, and it shows.
It's massively 90s nostalgic. It was on in the office last week, and everybody was reliving their university days, I think.
I believe every song on the soundtrack was released between 87 and 92.
Okay.
I believe. This is what Mr. Peck has said in an interview. There is a lot of good music. In fact, some of it is not on the official soundtrack, which is absolutely brilliant. That's the one we were listening to. The track that opens the film, Summer's Magic, didn't make it on. But the stuff like Primal Scream, Loaded, Soup Dragons, I'm Free, which is on Gary's mixtape, they're kind of singing along to. Happy Monday, Suede, The Doors. The Doors wasn't released between 87 and 92, so...
They lie.
I lied.
But when was The Doors film?
That was 1991.
Yeah. Ooh, so it works.
Kind of works.
I'm
giving them a little bit of a get out of jail free card, but still.
Yeah, but they were listening to all this stuff on iTunes while they were writing the script, and it shows, because the lyrics for a couple of the tracks have actually made it into the script as dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The idea that Gary King regurgitates lyrics that he hears, but he's no idea that he's actually regurgitating lyrics. He actually thinks he's come up with stuff like, you know, I'm free to do what I want any old time, and at the end when he yells the Primal Scream lyrics back, or the sample, back at the network.
This is a weird situation where I've edited the interview that you guys are referring to, so I would like to make an addendum to something that Edgar says erroneously. And Edgar, if you're listening, I mean no offence, I'm just doing you a favour. You refer to the film where that sample is taken from as The Young Angels. It's not The Young Angels, it's actually called The Wild Angels, if you guys want to look it up.
Oh, does he do? Oh, okay. That's so, simple mistake to make.
Simple mistake. Yeah. So there you go. Check it out. It was released in 1966, and it is very weird to see the actual... So what it is... What is it that you want to do?
Yeah, Peter Fonda. It's been... Yeah, I watched it with you just before we came up to do this. It's kind of weird.
It's very strange.
Does anyone know the thing at the very, very beginning of the movie? There's a what I presume is a sample from another film or an advert or something, a guy talking about man basically being a one-off and indefatigable creature.
No, it's the opening of Summer's Magic.
What's that?
Which is a song, I think. Mark Summers.
It is a Magic Round of Attention. But I didn't know that they were all linked, that sort of stuff. So, but I still want to know what film that's from, but what's that sampling? I want to know what that is.
It's a dream within your dream.
Because it obviously harks back. I mean, they're basically laying out right from the very beginning of the movie the theme of the movie, that mankind is unique and will not be starbucked by other planets, which is a lovely theme. And I guess something that you know, Simon has said this in the past. It harks back to both Sean and Fuzz, which is the individual against the collective. So it's Sean against the zombies, or Nicholas and Danny against the NWA. And I still love that joke. And in this movie, it's the guys against the blanks and the network. Which again, in act of foreshadowing, is foreshadowed in Pub 4 when their phones go down, and Andy says, "Oh, it must be in the network." Well, it is. I mean, it's insane how tight the script is, actually.
What is everyone's favourite musical moment from the film? Because I think mine's got to be the Doors song, Alabama song, which is when they're walking pissed, and there's that fantastic montage. And they actually played that on the set, I believe. So they were all walking in time with it. And then they all drink a pint time with it. But I absolutely love that. It's great, great sound.
Well, I'm not a big Primal Scream fan, but I now love that track.
Yeah.
Because it's just used brilliantly. I'm a huge fan of Teenage Fan Club. I'm really delighted to see that yet another Teenage Fan Club song has made it into movies after last year's the concept made it into young adult, and it's What You Do to Me, which is found in their album Bandwagon-esque, so, which is also where the concept comes from, so it's not their best album. It's weird, but anyway, there you go.
I'd have to go with Loaded, actually, because that made me laugh more than anything else.
Soup Dragon with I'm Free, is that it?
Yeah.
That's just a cracking tune, and you can't not love Fool's Gold.
Yeah.
That's obligatory.
It's interesting looking at the track listing, how many of the track titles sound sinister when you think of the plot. There's there's Join Our Club, 20 Seconds to Comply, There's No Other Way, but even Come Home by James applies to the plot.
Oh, really?
So,
okay.
Yeah. So it's not just like, hey, here's some tunes from the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, they've actually put a lot of thought into whether the lyrics and titles match up to what's going on.
The soundtrack's fantastic. I love Edgar Wright's use of pop songs throughout the movies so far. I'm not a huge fan, if I'm honest, of the scores in Sean, Fuzz and The World's End. But the use of pop songs is fantastic, absolutely fantastic. But, you know, those guys don't just throw this shit together, you know. And just to prove it, we spoke to Messrs. Pegg, Frost and Wright about all kinds of stuff, from the Pierce Brosnan cameo to the audacious ending and early iterations of the story, including a possible 13th pub. And they were talking to myself and Helen. Enjoy.
Yeah, we've got a question here from Mr. I Like to Spoil the World's End, who asks, I guess, where do you want to start, Helen? What's your first...
Well, the 12 pub names, did they have a particular meaning, the names?
Yes.
Yes, they do. And if you look back across them, then they pretty much describe what happens within. You know, the first post is the first one, and the old familiar is exactly the same as the first post. The famous cock is Gary, obviously.
Kind of at his worst.
Yeah, at his worst, he comes back. The Crosshands is where the first fight happens. The Good Companions is where they decide to stick together and, you know, carry on with the crawl.
Friends.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
The Trusty Servant is Smiley's character, the Reverend Green, who is this, you know, who is the one of the humans that has agreed to go along with what's going on. The Two-Headed Dog is the twins, the Mermaid of the Marmalade Sandwich, because they're sirens.
The sirens. Beehive,
the beehive
is the hive of, like, of
activity.
Of activity, alien activity.
The King's Head is Gary's mind kind of thing, you know, it's like... the hole in the wall is obvious because it's literal.
Yes.
And then there's the World's
and
End.
And the World's End is obvious too.
Yeah. The King's Head, complete with a picture of you above the...
I know. Which that pub has kept.
That really? Pub is changing its name to the King's Head and keeping that sign. Isn't that amazing?
So that looks like a live version rendering from the film Dogtanyan.
It does look like Dogtanyan.
If Dogtanyan was real, it's a BuzzFeed thing.
Did you go through
many... That Simon's playing one of the Musker Hounds.
That'll be on the internet in seconds, you know that. Did you go through any iterations of the names in terms of fitting into the plot and making
We sort of knew what we wanted to happen in the scenes, and then we went... We had one of those big book of pub names, and we went... And all of the pub names are real. I mean, the truth of it is that the World's End itself, why we always stuck to that title, is because that is a pub where me and Simon used to meet sometimes, because we used to, when you still lived in Kentish Town, I think, and I was in Islington, we would meet at the World's End in Camden and go to Odeon Camden Parkway and watch films such as X-Men or Run Lola Run.
Yeah. We'd also seen gigs downstairs. What was that place under the World's? Yeah, Underworld. We'd seen gigs there as well.
So that it always stuck in my mind, even though there are more than one... there are more pubs called the World's End. It always stuck in my mind that was an interesting
interesting World's End fact, actually, seeing as we're in this territory, is that originally in the script there were 13 pubs. We pulled it down to 12 because it felt more in keeping with the 12 steps of recovery. But the 13th pub was called the Bald Faced Stag and featured a scene where Gary King mined along to the whole of Bat Dance.
It seemed like when it came to sort of like cut a pub out, it was unfortunately the one I was thinking maybe we should lose that Bat Dance scene. So a longer version of the script would have featured the whole of Bat Dance. You know, Prince probably would not have cleared it.
Probably
so
not.
Then
well,
it may never have happened anyway.
Just film it so we can stick it on the DVD, is that...
We never shot it.
Weirdly, it was one of the first ideas we had, and I remember when we were doing press for Paul, I think it was, in America, some kid gave me the Batman soundtrack, and I was so shocked because it was like, we've just had this idea about, you know, because obviously we make reference to it in Shaun of the Dead, and to have a whole scene in The World's End where Gary, like, and to their horror, they're watching him do this and he does this really elaborate dance routine to it.
Our backup one, in case Prince said no, was Doctoring the TARDIS by the Time Lords.
Probably said yes.
But you know what you'd have done then? That would equally thorny, because then you have been giving Gary Glitter money.
Don't do that. That's a bad
thing. It is.
That is true. At which point in the movie would that have come?
It was four or five. It was before the Crosshands.
That's right, it would have
been four, and Crosshands would have been five.
I mean, there's a lot of foreshadowing in the movie. The whole thing's just beautifully constructed. There's so many calls back to things we've seen before. I mean, how do you fit it all together? How do you jigsaw it all?
I think we just, you know, when we write the script, we just try and dovetail, you know, that's the thing, is that in the first, 30 minutes of the film, it's quite a slow burn. Mm. And we wanted to feel like that you could make a movie where it could just continue as a sort of a comedy drama and feel like sort of like a nice Mike Lee type film about these friends. But in every scene, everything they're talking about is all setting up for some payoff later. So you know, it was just, we would do a chart. We'd do our flip chart thing, but we would like list out all the pubs and then we would write what things we wanted to happen in that and which people are going to appear here and come back later and what like themes we were going to set up. So we would just be extremely, so there's not really like a line or a bit that doesn't somehow come back later. And, you know, we love that kind of thing. I think we like rewarding the audience's patience, or like for the people, the sharp-eared people out there, they kind of can see that there's something on a surface level to enjoy in the scene because it's funny and the actors are great. But then there's something else going on as well. And there's lots of little setups all the way through.
We're very meticulous this time, and even more so than usual, I think. After Hot Fuzz, which felt like it got so huge and we had to sort of wrestle it into something, we decided to always have a plan to make this about 105 minutes long, I think was our initial kind of pitch, and then literally break it down into page numbering and look at it quite scientifically in the outset to try and, you know, make it the right shape, and it worked as a technique. You know, we were pretty studious about it, and I enjoyed that aspect of it this time. It felt like we had a Hot Fuzz, we kind of let it go for a bit and it was suddenly 180 pages long, whereas this, it was always about 105, hovering around that area, 110 105, and it was a much more sort of productive process, I think.
But does that mean there's a room for improvisation in this? Because Edgar, you told me once that Nick improvised possibly the funniest line in the movie, which
I think that came out in rehearsals, didn't it?
Was it rehearsals?
Smashy, smashy Eggman? I can't remember which of the two of you actually came up with that one. I don't know.
I think it was just a joint.
Yeah, but that was in rehearsal. We don't really... There's nothing in the... Yeah. What we'd like to do is write the script and then rehearse it with the actors and then funny lines that come out of that, including smashy, smashy Eggman, and then written into the script. So on the day, because it's always like an ambitious schedule and we got so much to cram in, like, you know, and especially on a film like this where there's a lot of action and effects in it, it means that you have to kind of get through the dialogue scenes a bit quicker, which is also, I think, good for the actors anyway, because if you're shooting an argument scene, you don't want an argument scene to go over 2 days. You want to do it all in one day. So we're pretty like we stick to the script basically, but we have workshopped it and we have rehearsed it before that.
Is that because actors do? If you do an argument scene over 2 days, does it fester a little bit?
You lose the gravitas or the, you know, it just becomes
it's
less
not
arguing,
as much fun as fighting physically, which is much more fun. Just want to get it over with.
So when you came up with the name The World's End, did that suggest you the scale of the movie, or did you have the scale in mind already?
We knew what we wanted to kind of like, what the threat was going to be, and it's funny, this is going way, way back. There was at one point a really silly idea that was one of those kind of fanciful like pie in the sky ideas that we were excited about for an afternoon and then thought that's impossible. Is we thought of doing a sequel to Shaun of the Dead where it would be an alternate reality sequel where Shaun would turn left instead of right, and instead of it being a zombie film, it would be like a body snatchers film. And it's funny, I think we talked about it for an afternoon very excitedly and then thought it would be impossible because you'd have to do it right now, otherwise the actors are going to look older and it'll all look weird. But, you know, one of the gems that came away from that is that there's something nice about paranoid sci-fi of the John Wyndham, John Christopher like ilk, is that like where the threat is intelligent and can talk and is like sort of claiming identities, it ties really nicely into the idea of reunions and also the idea of have these characters changed. You've got four guys who become grown-ups, you've got Gary King who is like sort of like pretending to be a teenager, and then you've got this town which is this weird facsimile of what they once knew. And so that always tied into the sci-fi theme. And then, like, you know, as the film progresses, we get deeper and deeper into that in terms of like, what if we could offer you a way to kind of be your young self and elements like that. But so we always knew where we wanted to end up. In the very original idea for the story, we had the idea that they'd actually go back in time, and that sort of became so unwieldy, and also felt like it maybe been done in other movies. We you know, even like Back to the Future type thing, Part 2. Just thought, let's ditch that, and then we came up with how to end it with the same grace note at the very end.
We love the idea of that Gary eventually wound up with his original young friends. The only way we could figure that at first was a time travel thing. But as Edgar said, we had this kind of like, you know, we doubted that the soundness of that idea. So when the idea of the network arose and we started to, you know, kind of hatch out this idea of this sort of intergalactic Starbucks sort of, you know, Witherspooning the universe, it became apparent that we would be able to do it because we could have Gary with his the counterparts of his younger selves. And that was always our, in the same way that Ed in the Shed was, long before we wrote the whole of Shaun of the Dead, that image was always going to be the last image. It was a happy ending. It was Shaun and Ed together, you know.
It was nice to do end scenes which tease the idea of further adventures that we'll never shoot.
Yeah. I was going to ask about the apocalyptic kind of ending, because you know, most movies like this is about averting the apocalypse, and in this one it's actually kind of causing it.
Yeah. Well, that was a big thing that actually differentiated it from both Shaun and sort of other, you know, movies like sort of about the apocalypse, you know, like serious ones as well, is that in Shaun, it's not Shaun's fault that there's a zombie apocalypse and it's not his job to save the day. But in this film, it might be Gary King's fault that all this has happened. And so we like this idea of Gary King as a character who starts as a social nuisance, yeah, that becomes a cosmic nuisance. Like, and one of the big ideas about it, there's this thing of like, you can't argue with a drunk. And what if that guy that you cannot argue with in a bar is now having like a face off with some kind of alien god? It's like, this is like,
and has a lawyer with him,
and there's the best and the worst person to get into an argument with. So we like this, like, you know, because it's that thing of like, sort of like Simon's character is an extremely unlikely hero and does a lot of bad things in the movie, but we always have a lot of sympathy for our characters, and it's like, how can this character pull triumph out of like absolute rock bottom? And I think he does, in a way, you know. It's like, you, I would hope that the audience would be on his side, you know, versus the galactic Wetherspoons.
Yeah. Well, also because it's what they're offering is kind of, you know, it's not terrible, really. It's kind of peace, and but they're offering beige as the future of Earth, and you know, as human beings, don't want that. And so Gary really does, you know, he steps in on behalf of humanity, and he kind of does the right thing, even though what it results in is the apocalypse. And we figured we had to go through with that. It couldn't be a cop out. We had to cause an end. In some respects, of the way we live.
It's funny, I think we're all of the age where we grew up in the cruise missile crisis, and I remember that very vividly being something that I was very scared about as a kid. And then when Threads was on TV, I remember that really vividly as being like absolutely terrifying. And watching it again recently, we watched it, didn't we?
We did,
like the end of Threads, where they end up in like a sort of essentially like a go back to like
medieval
sort of. Feudal times.
Horrible.
Sort of neo-medieval, like sort of tilling the land and sort of like scraping around for like crops. It always really struck me, that nuclear winter ending. So I was trying to think of this, we tried to conceive of this kind of climax that would actually somehow be like a happy end of the world.
I am for those times.
Exactly. But that's the thing. But that's exactly it. You do get the feeling that Andy might be a little happier as a hunter-gatherer at the end.
It's audacious as well, because not only does Gary, you know, cause the destruction of most of the human race, but, you know, from a storytelling point of view, Gary starts off narrating the film, but Andy finishes it. Can you talk about that decision as well? And
that was just as a sort of nice poetic bookend, is that, like, you know, the out of the sort of the, you know, like it's Simon and Nick are the sort of the leads, is to have one like do the prologue and one do the epilogue. I thought it was kind of sort of sweet in a way, because also what's nice about it is that Gary is extremely wistful about 1990, but at the end, Andy, after being sort of extremely tough on Gary and rightly so throughout, gets to be wistful about 1990 as well at the very end, which I think is like a sweet kind of bookend, basically.
And Nick, you also get the you get the cornetto shot.
Yeah, I do.
In this one,
I'm thrilled.
Was that a real
they
rapper?
Call it the Walls Pop Shot.
They do call it the Walls Pop Shot. Yeah, it was.
Was it? How many takes did that take? Because I imagine
a bunch, right? It was like the world's smallest kite, wasn't it? That's how they did. They kind of flew it into shot. Yeah, it was amazing.
And did you have to run that line at the end past Primal Scream?
If you look at the end credits, it actually says copyright MGM. Dialogue from the Young Angels. So you had to clear it with the original film, because that's actually the clip.
The sample, isn't it?
The sample from Loaded Primal Scream is from a biker movie, a Roger Corman biker movie called The Young Angels. But that was always that was in the first draft of the script, was that like that is what he's got going on in his brain. The soundtrack of the movie, all these kind of hedonistic late 80s, early 90s, like baggy, druggy kind of like party anthems. A lot of which have never gone away. Like, I was in IKEA and I heard like I'm Free by the Super Dragons playing in LA. I was in LA and I heard the Super Dragons playing. I was like, what? Like after we'd made the movie. But we like this idea that Gary King as a character, those are his hymns. Like he's going to take those songs and he's going to live those songs. And like that's on constant repeat on the stereo. And those are the, you know, that's the his tablets.
We laughed a lot during rehearsal when we decided that me and Paddy would do the chiming in.
Yeah.
We laughed a lot. That made us laugh a lot that we thought, fuck it, let's do the whole thing.
Just a couple of very last quick questions, guys. One of my favourite scenes was the Jaws scene, the scars comparison scene.
See, I would think of that as the Thing scene, but you're right, it's the Jaws scene.
It's a bit of both, I guess. Yeah. You mentioned there's a reference to the knife trick from Aliens.
Yes.
Which made me think, have you guys done this? Have you tried?
He scarred my thumb up.
I did. I stabbed him on. Was it on Space, wasn't it?
It was on Shaun of the... Yes.
Oh, was it? Oh, Space. Yes, so we were doing the tank scene.
I think that's the only reference to a film. Yeah. There's only two references to films that in dialogue. Like The Omen.
The Omen and...
And Aliens. And call it the knife. Is that funny thing? Is it's really quickly that anybody who knows that is like saying we play the knife game from Aliens, and everybody knows what you're talking about.
We agonise about it. So we don't want to make any references in this movie. We don't want to carry on being the guys that make references, particularly after we splurged so many in Paul. It was like that's it was over. It was over.
The reference.
So we were trying to figure out a way to describe this game, and we had to go with that's how everyone knows it. It's the knife game from Aliens. So yeah.
So
but that joke there with Nick doing that was quite a late joke in the writing process, and it makes me laugh.
You get a nice shot of Paddy Considine's ass.
Mm.
We do.
we do indeed.
Sweet.
It's got something for everyone, that scene, hasn't it?
It's really scalloped.
And the last very, very quick thing is it's full of cameos.
Considine's ass sounds actually like a great pub.
It does, doesn't it?
The Considine's ass.
The Brosnan cameo. How did they happen? How did they come about? Is this a grand tradition of ex-Bonds in your movies?
Well, the thing is now, what we plan to do for the 10th anniversary of Shaun of the Dead is digitally insert Roger Moore into Shaun of the Dead.
So they're
about to make the whole
as Edge.
Yeah, no, he's now going to be playing...
face replacement.
Yeah, he's now going to be playing...
Could I get any of your cans of drink?
Piers is playing, like, essentially my old drama teacher, Mr. Wilde.
Mr. Wilde.
Yeah, he was in the script, he was called Mr. Wilde for a long time. Mr. Wilde is actually in Hot Fuzz, and then we changed to Mr. Shepherd because the character is like the shepherd who's going to lead them to like a better life. And it was great working with him because it was like just working on the costume is like we wanted him to look like a trendy teacher. And one of the things is like the Guy Speranza, the great costume designer, he found this picture of Eric Clapton. I said, "That's exactly it." Eric Clapton in like 1992. I said, "That's exactly it." But Piers was great. I mean, he's got such an amazing voice. And in fact, one of his lines in it is the line in the film that whenever I'm watching it, I chime along with it because it makes me laugh so much. As Piers going, "No, Peter, of course I'm not a robot." It's like it makes me laugh every time. He's so great. I mean, you know, when he comes on screen, when you have his first like speaking shot, he's got such. I mean, the man's a fucking movie star. It's incredible.
We watched him at that day.
We did.
We didn't have much dialogue, and he just sat there and he did his long monologue. We just all kind of watched him and fell into him.
You see in the scene that everybody is getting kind of lost in Pierce's eyes.
Two things about him which I loved was, when we first offered him the role, we went to meet him at a hotel that he usually stays in when he's in London. And he read the scene for us. He kind of just did it. We didn't ask him to. He just did it for us. And we were kind of... And I think one of the things that was really sweet, that he wanted just to make sure he was in on the joke. He invited Edgar and I along just to make sure. You know, he's in a comedy. He doesn't usually do comedy. And even when he does, he usually plays quite a serious character. And I think
Mrs. Doubtfire?
Well, yeah, that's what I meant.
Attacks.
I know. But when... I think he wanted to just know that he was in on it, which is incredibly sweet for someone as movie star-like as him and as confident and great that he... He had that vulnerability to him, which I had enormous respect for. And then on set, he was never not there for offlines.
He always
appeared for offlines.
But he just sat with us too. He didn't go back to his trailer. He just sat with us and hung out. And
he would always.
And he was afraid of a drive-by fruiting. What?
It's from Mrs. Doubtfire.
Oh right. Oh my god!
But he was great, and it was weird with the prologue because we thought, oh, people are going to see him and know he's got to come back because you know, yeah. when you're well versed in movie, you know, the language of movies, you think if you see someone early on, if you see a picture of an actor, you know that actor's going to be in the film. But
tell me something, what is, with that in mind of like the fact that he doesn't appear until later, what is happening in the first scene with his kind of shot? Can you tell me what's going on?
I was about to say grooming.
No, but he's like, out. No. Oh my god.
Well, listen, no, in this like, day and age,
Pierce is out of focus in every shot. Like the focus, like so I deliberately, like, it was a funny thing to have a main, like a main, like sort of a huge actor, and go like, put Pierce out of focus, put the focus on Thomas all the time. So yeah.
On that Brosnan bombshell, guys. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Cheers.
Peg, Frost and Wright there, and there was tons of things we didn't even get around to asking him, but hopefully we can lure them back into the pod booth for another session at some point. And that is it for a World's End spoiler special. Hope you enjoyed listening to it. We won't be back with a spoiler special for another couple of months, I'd say. Probably Thor the Dark World. Helen, would you say
I think that's probably the next spoilery one, yeah.
Hunger Games?
I think that's after Thor, isn't it?
Okay. Hobbit?
Yeah.
Maybe. Okay. So we'll, at some point, we'll have another spoiler special. But until then, it is goodbye from Helen.
Goodbye.
It is goodbye from Ali.
Bye now.
It's goodbye from Nick.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from me. Let's boo-boo.